This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, confirmation of a missing piece from last year's doomed Malaysia Airlines flight. President Obama vigorously defends the Iran nuclear agreement. Horses make faces like humans.
They can move the skin above their eyes to raise that skin a little bit like humans can. And they've got a really extensive set of muscles in the lower face around the mouth that they can use.
A country music superstar's marriage breaks up. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak confirmed that a Boeing 777 wing segment discovered on an island in the Indian Ocean is from the missing flight MH370, which disappeared 17 months ago en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Prime Minister Najib fought back emotion as he broke the news Wednesday in Kuala Lumpur.
We now have physical evidence that, as I announced on 24th March, last year, flight MH370 tragically ended in the southern Indian Ocean.
The discovery of the barnacle-encrusted wing section known as a flaperon was the first real breakthrough in the search for the plane that disappeared in March of 2014 with 239 passengers and crew on board. The wing washed up on Reunion, a French territory near Madagascar, a week ago, and was flown to Paris for further examination and identification. Mr. Najib said the discovery gives victims' families a chance to grieve.
The burden and uncertainty faced by the families during this time has been unspeakable. It is my hope that this confirmation, however tragic and painful, will at least bring certainty to the families and loved ones.
The Malaysian Prime Minister sought to reassure the families that his government would do everything within its power to find out why the plane went down.
I would like to assure all those affected by this tragedy that the government of Malaysia is committed to do everything within our means to find out the truth of what happened. MH370's disappearance.
Searchers continue to scour a huge area of the Indian Ocean looking for the plane. Theories about what happened include bad weather, a hijacking, or that the pilot deliberately crashed the jet. Staying on the Malaysia Airlines flight story, it's time now to check out what people are saying about the developments on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to bring us the latest snippets. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. Let's start with Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak's tweet from earlier Wednesday. He's on Twitter at Najib Razak. He shared a link to his Facebook post on the announcement and added, "An international team of experts conclusively confirmed the aircraft debris found on Reunion Island is indeed from MH370. That's been retweeted about 700 times.
And gee, what about from Malaysia Airlines itself? Did they tweet anything?
They sure did. It's on Twitter at MAS, that's M-A-S. But instead of tweeting the latest news, it posted an image of a ribbon, and that was in the pattern of the fabric for the flight attendants' uniforms. That tweet has been shared more than 1,000 times. It also included hashtag AlwaysInMyHeart and hashtag MH370.
Are those in any way popular hashtags?
Absolutely. Hashtag MH370 is the most widely used hashtag for the missing jet based on search results on the social media analytics website Topsy. The hashtag was used more than 39,000 times in the last 24 hours, and hashtag Malaysia Airlines was used more than 1,100 times in the same time frame. Ray?
Thank you, G, for the latest update. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Obama is urging critics of the Iran nuclear agreement to choose diplomacy over war. He continued to rally congressional support for the deal in a speech at American University in Washington. White House correspondent Aru Pandey reports.
The president stood at the same university where more than 50 years ago, then-President John F. Kennedy first called for nuclear disarmament and a nuclear test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, a fact not lost on Mr. Obama.
He rejected the prevailing attitude among some foreign policy circles that equated security with a perpetual war footing.
Calling the Iran nuclear agreement the most consequential debate the United States has had since the 2002 decision to invade Iraq, President Obama warned U.S. lawmakers against blocking what he called a very good deal.
We have to be honest. Congressional rejection of this deal leaves any U.S. administration that is absolutely committed to preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon with one option: another war in the Middle East.
In the nearly hour-long speech, Mr. Obama laid out a forceful rebuttal to critics who say the agreement, including its inspections regime, is not strong enough and that sanctions relief will embolden Iran. The president said those who believe the U.S. can walk away from the deal and maintain pressure on Iran are, quote, selling a fantasy. He noted the stark choice between diplomacy and war, warning military action would be far less effective in preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
It would likely guarantee that inspectors are kicked out of Iran. It is probable that it would drive Iran's program deeper underground. It would certainly destroy the international unity that we spent so many years building.
The president said lawmakers' rejection of a diplomatic solution would damage the United States in the eyes of the world.
If Congress kills this deal, we will lose more than just constraints on Iran's nuclear program or the sanctions we have painstakingly built. We will have lost something more precious: America's credibility as a leader of diplomacy.
Mr. Obama called on Americans to contact their lawmakers and voice support for the agreement. Congress has until mid-September to vote on the deal. The president can veto any disapproval, but needs the support of fellow Democrats to ensure his veto is not overridden and the deal goes forward. Aru Pandey, VOA News, The White House.
For some more perspective on President Obama's speech, International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Daria Dasa-Kay, an analyst with the RAND Corporation Santa Monica, California office. She says that the Obama administration sales pitch is working in the Gulf region, but faces a tough road here at home.
Well, I think he's moving in the right direction. He obviously has sent his senior officials to the region, and that effort looks relatively successful. The Saudis and other GCC states have cautiously approved the deal, and so that's a pretty big win for the administration. But there's a lot of explaining still to do to the American public, and in fact, polling shows that the more information the public has, and the more they understand the alternatives, the more likely they are to either support or at least not reject the deal.
As far as Washington and the public in general are concerned, how much of the objection to this agreement concerns its actual details and how much seems to be election cycle politics?
By and large, most arms control analysts believe this is a very, very strong agreement. No agreement is perfect. No agreement is risk-free. But it is a very, very detailed arms control agreement, probably the most significant arms control agreement of this nature that's ever been done internationally, the strongest verification system that's ever been constructed. I think, you know, there's a lot of questions about how the deal will ultimately be implemented, whether you can trust Iran and so forth. But, you know, the deal really builds in the possibility that Iran will cheat. And so there's a lot to be said for the terms of the agreement itself. If the goal ultimately is to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran, it does it pretty effectively for the foreseeable future.
The Obama administration has said that without this agreement with Iran, the only alternative would be military action against that state. Do you accept that as a viable position or just rhetoric?
I think a lot of critics of the deal really don't like the president's framing of this as the deal or war, and it is understandable. I wouldn't say it's just rhetoric, because I do think there's a case to be made that if this deal, at this juncture, after being approved by the international community, if the U.S. backs down on this deal and rejects it, unfortunately, you're left with the worst of both worlds, an unconstrained Iran able to reconstitute its nuclear program, and an eroding of sanctions. So it does leave a very difficult situation, and the potential for conflict to be higher. That doesn't mean tomorrow there will be war if Congress rejects this deal. But obviously the president is trying to frame it in these stark terms, very much going after especially the Democrats in Congress who may be on the fence, who may be very worried about the alternative. So it's not surprising that this kind of framing is being used at this stage of the game when he's really trying to do a hard sell.
That's Daria Dasikay of the RAND Corporation Santa Monica, California office, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Troops loyal to deposed Yemeni President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, with help from a Saudi-led air campaign, have retaken much of the southern portion of the country from Houthi insurgents, including a provincial capital. The pro-government forces pursued Shiite Houthi fighters Wednesday after taking about 10 southern villages, the Al Anad Air Base, and then the Lahaj provincial capital of Houta in recent days. The Iranian-backed Houthis still control much of the north and Sana'a, the capital. The UN Children's Fund UNICEF is warning that millions of children in war-torn Yemen are losing out on an education and a bright future. UNICEF says it's working with the Ministry of Education to get as many children as possible back to school by the September 5th starting date. Lisa Schlein has details.
4 months of intensive bombing have devastated Yemen's school system, causing nearly 2 million children to miss out on their education. One of the most tragic aspects of this war is that hundreds of children have lost their lives, so school is no longer an option. UNICEF reports 365 children have been killed and 484 injured since Saudi Arabia began airstrikes against Houthi rebels on March 26th. In addition, it says the bombing and street fighting have forced more than 3,600 schools to close and thousands of families to flee to safer areas in the country. It says around 250 schools have been damaged and 270 others are being used as shelters for internally displaced people, while 68 are occupied by armed groups. To compensate for this major loss of school facilities, UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouyrak says temporary learning spaces such as tents will be provided. School is scheduled to start on September 5th, depending on the security situation. But before that date, Bouyrak tells VOA another deadline looms. He says more than 200,000 students in grades 9 through 12 have to take national exams due to start in mid-August.
There are a convergence of efforts, and we are really supporting that to make sure that these children, starting now, will have 3 weeks of catch-up learning to make sure that they have a chance to attend and to pass their national examination, grade 9 and 12. Otherwise, the year is just lost.
The children must pass the examinations to obtain their basic or secondary school certificates. Buyarak says so-called catch-up classes also will be provided for some 1.8 million children who hope to return to school in September. He says these children have missed out on more than 2 months of their education because of the conflict. To help make the return to school in war-torn Yemen possible, UNICEF is appealing for $11 million. It says the money will be used to support the rehabilitation of damaged schools, provide school supplies, train teachers and community workers, and get traumatized children the psychological support they need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the time of year in the United States when families take vacations, and many of them will drive. The price of gasoline is lower now than it was last year. New figures are out on U.S. crude oil inventories. VOA business correspondent Alexis Christophers in New York has more on the latest numbers and their effect on oil prices.
This report from the Energy Information Administration finds that U.S. crude inventories fell more than expected in the latest week by 4.4 million barrels. Crude imports also fell by 370,000 barrels a day. Analysts agree this report is bullish for crude, with refining up and imports down. U.S. refineries were running at 96.1% of capacity in the latest week. The last time the country's refineries ran at that level was more than 10 years ago. One reason for the boom in refining is that U.S. drivers posted a new all-time high for miles driven in May. Also, there has been a steady rise in product exports, and California's refineries are coming back online after some unscheduled repairs. The report helped to send crude prices up about 1% on the day.
VOA's business reporter Alexis Christophorus in New York. A new form of digital malware that preys on users' implicit trust in major online brands such as YouTube or Adobe is rapidly spreading across the Internet. Worse yet, according to a just-released study, that these malvertisements may soon become the primary means of distributing malware, leaving users with little or no defense. My colleague Susan Yockey spoke with International Edition's Doug Bernard, who follows cyber issues.
This is a real threat and that is growing, really spiking in terms of popularity.
So what does a malvertisement look like?
Well, a malvertisement, which is just a combination of the words malware and advertisement, looks exactly like all those other 1,000 advertisements you see on any given day when you go to websites, blogs, social networks, that kind of thing.
All those little things on the side there.
That pop up that are advertising things that you might be interested in buying. But, and you don't know this, they look exactly like every other ad, which is why they're so successful in tricking people.
How does it work?
So basically, in this online advertising ecosystem, websites are constantly sharing information about who you are, your friends, your searches, your online activity. And that's why you get all these ads online that, you know, if you happen to be at Amazon earlier today looking for shoes, you go to Facebook hours later and here's an ad for shoes. It's kind of creepy, but that's how they know so much about you. So these advertisements, malvertisements, I should say, look like ads. They use the same data, but when you click on them, they obviously download malware of some kind, a Trojan horse or something bad. And increasingly, it's not just ads, but it's pop-ups. So, for example, I was speaking with James Pledger, who conducted this research for the firm Risk IQ, and he said what he's most alarmed about is the increase in pop-up ads that look like you're supposed to update your software.
So you go to a common website and you're popped up with your flash is out of date and you need to update. And this is not actually flash that's out of date. It's an advertisement inside the website and it's telling you to download software. And this software is actually malware. And people click on that and they are, you know, easily tricked into downloading that and running that.
So you think you're updating your software such as flash or something like that, but what's really happening is you're being tricked into downloading malware.
So what can we do?
Well, it's the basic web hygiene stuff. The companies like Amazon and YouTube and others that host these things inadvertently are doing their best to fight it, but it's very difficult. So, you know, it's recommended that, for example, you always keep your software updated. Some of this is going to sound familiar. Don't wait for a pop-up and don't click on those pop-ups. Go to the vendor site particularly so you can update your software. Also, again, as we've said before, use strong passwords. change them often, and don't use the same password across different systems. These are things that I think we all know we're supposed to do, but frankly, very few of us do.
International Edition's Doug Bernard speaking with Susan Yockey. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? How about old school technique meeting new age technology? Charging your smartphone with a candle. Set it up by placing the charger on top of a two-tier stand and pour water into the charger. A lit candle goes under the charger. Plug your mobile phone into a USB port coming off the charger, and that's it.
You have a hot side, like a hot plate, and you have a cold plate, and you smash these generators together, and it's that temperature difference. It creates a diffusion of energy from the hot side to the cold side.
Andrew Burns, co-founder of the startup company Stower, says the charger puts out between 2 and 3 watts, about the same amount of power available from a USB port.
The power of a mobile handset and a smartphone is infinitely greater than a vacuum cleaner, and they only need tiny little bits of energy.
Candle power, keeping smartphones lit. That's what's new from the Voice of America. I'm Todd Grossan.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition in Washington. As many horse fanciers will tell you, they only have to look into those big eyes to tell how their horse is feeling. They could be right about that. There is new evidence that horses make facial expressions just like we do. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Horse owners know that the creatures are very social by nature. Their emotions may also be written on their faces like humans. British researchers studied video images of horses and report in the journal PLOS One that equines make at least 17 action units or facial expressions. The muscles in the human face allow us to make 27 facial expressions, reflecting different moods from anger to jealousy to amusement. Chimps, in comparison, make 13 different facial gestures, and dogs have been found to have 16 discrete looks, which any dog owner will tell you can convey happiness, sadness, or what looks like guilt at stealing table scraps. An entire index of horsey faces called the Equine Facial Action Coding System, or Equifax, has been developed by researchers at the University of Sussex, along with fellow researchers at the University of Portsmouth and Duquesne University. Animal behaviorist Jan Watham led the study. She says horses can move their faces in a surprising number of human-like ways.
You know, they can move the skin above their eyes to raise that skin a little bit like humans can, and they've got a really extensive set of muscles in the lower face around the mouth that they can use. I mean, they do use their mouth to explore their environment, because obviously their hooves aren't very good for that, but they also use their mouth to make facial expressions, and we think that that's for communication, perhaps for emotional communication. But that's another study in itself that we're working on.
Investigators watched videos of horses in a variety of situations, including interacting with other horses and with veterinarians, to catalog all of their facial expressions. Wathan says researchers want to try to relate the facial expressions of horses to emotions they might be feeling and discover whether horses can communicate those feelings to one another through their faces. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
First, it was Blake Shelton and Miranda Lambert who announced they were splitting up. Now, Reba McEntire and her husband of 26 years, Narvel Blackstock, have announced they're calling it quits and divorcing. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about this most recent high-profile breakup.
And it may be also a sign of the times that divorce is now an option. So I think they're taking advantage of it.
Oh,
that sounds
no.
Terrible.
You got money, I got money. Bye.
Bye. So, yeah, so, that you know, Reba posted on her her Facebook page, but it's on her website, and that her and her husband, says Narvel Blackstock, and Narvel Blackstock and Reba McEntire have announced that they have been separated for the past few months. Despite this being the end of their marriage, they continue to support each other. They have worked together for 35 years and will continue to do so. They have asked that you respect their privacy during this time. I mean, it's kind of sad. He's been her manager for 35 years.
Well, he was a steel guitar player in her band first.
He was before.
And they got married at like 1989 or something?
Yes, on a boat in Lake Tahoe. And what's kind of nice is that when they got home, they discovered that she was pregnant.
Oh, yeah. Now, her son, their son,
yes,
is a NASCAR driver.
Yes, he is. He is. And then I know that Blackstock has 3 children from a previous marriage. What's interesting is that Blackstock Management, his company, they're still going to represent Reba, of course, but they also represent Blake Shelton. And then on top of that, you also know that Gwen Stefani, who's a judge of The Voice, working with Blake Shelton.
Right. We're not doing a 6 degrees of separation.
Oh, God.
Thing.
I'm just like, what is going on? What is in the water? She just announced within hours of Reba's announcement that she's divorcing her husband.
Well, this is, we don't know the ins and outs of a relationship with these two people. I'm always saddened to see a marriage end just because it makes me sad.
Yeah.
But sometimes people do actually, you know, there are circumstances where it's like it's better for them to be apart.
I know.
Well, if you want to send us a tweet about this, you can send one to Nikki at VOA_music. You can send one to us at VOA_IE. You can also listen for Nikki's show, Country Hits USA. That's on www.voanews.com.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information along with pictures and video on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Afghan Minister of Finance Ekhlil Hakimi, the U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan P. Michael McKinley, and the USAID Mission Director William Hemmink signed a Memorandum of Understanding for the New Development Partnership on August 3, 2015 in Kabul. The New Development Partnership reflects the strategic importance of the U.S.-Afghanistan relationship and recognizes a new era of development cooperation between our governments. This initiative delivers on the commitment made during Afghan President Ashraf Ghani's March visit to Washington, during which President Barack Obama pledged to support the Afghan National Unity Government's efforts to achieve its own ambitious reform agenda. Afghanistan's Minister of Finance Hakimi thanked the U.S. for its generous support with the New Development Partnership, under which the U.S. will provide up to $800 million to Afghanistan to maintain and build on the development gains made over the last 13 years. U.S. Ambassador P. Michael McKinley remarked that the New Development Partnership represents a fundamental transformation in the nature of development cooperation between our two countries. It empowers Afghan solutions to Afghan challenges by incentivizing and rewarding Afghan successes. Afghanistan continues to face difficult challenges, recovery from decades of violent conflict, the continuing threat of violent extremism, the need to provide education, health care, and basic infrastructure for millions of men, women, and children. In meeting these challenges, Afghanistan will have the continued help of its friend and ally, the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.